Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Fall Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Matt Kinnear and Christian Sweezy, and we are here for part three, the ultimate podcast for, and by ultimate, I don't mean the best, although there aren't that many lacrosse podcasts rolling around, particularly in the fall, so, but I do mean the last, the final in the series, the three-part series of podcasts that are recapping fall lacrosse, previewing the 2016 season, and trying to accompany you on your travels. As we bring the 2015 calendar to a close, we are going to go over the MAC, the NEC, the Patriot League, and the Southern Conference. And we're going to start with the Patriot League, break from the alphabetical order, and we're going to give the reason that they are the biggest league, although we are dealing with four of the biggest conferences in college lacrosse. But we're going to start with the Patriot League. A very interesting 2015 season in the Patriot League. After Loyola ran the table in their first campaign through en route to a opening round NCAA tournament loss to Albany. They struggled. They had more challenges, a stiffer competition in 2015 than they had the year prior. And to me, it's a league that you can kind of jumble pretty much all of the top six. You know, Christian, kind of kicking it off, I think the most interesting or maybe the story that got the most attention last year was in the league was Navy's, you know, kind of push. This was a building year, and they certainly did that. And I would assume highlighted by the regular season victory over Army. What do you see as being, if not necessarily a similar storyline, than the possible thing that captures that level of attention this year?
I think Colgate is going to be pretty good. I know that they have a lot of shooters. Their attack can do a lot of different things. Abadesa from Arizona, a sophomore, started last year as a freshman, very, very quick. Chase Wittick, also a sophomore who started as a freshman, tends to be a pretty good shooter, but they have great midfield shooters. Cam Williams, a senior from Columbus, mm-hmm. Ohio, who wears number one because he was Mike Murphy's first recruit, apparently, at Colgate. Didn't even want to wear number one, but Murphy's like, yeah, wear number one. So, but he's an incredible shooter, picks corners. He had a great Patriot League tournament. So I think, you know, and Colgate was in that North Carolina playoff game. I appreciate that they lost by three or four, but they were in it. It was a close game for a while, and they were in the game with Syracuse, too, in the regular season finale. So I'm very – I think Colgate is probably the team to watch. I saw Navy twice. I love their athletes. I love their defense. I think Reese and Fennell, two junior defensemen, would play for anybody. Like, full-on would start for any program in the country. John Connors, whose numbers I was surprised. He was at 50% save percentage last year in the fall. He looked more like a 58-60% save percentage guy. So, I mean, I like Navy, I like their athletes. Obviously, we haven't even started to talk about Loyola yet, but I suspect Colgate will be the team we're talking the most about in May.
Interesting thing that you mentioned, all the good shooters for Colgate. I was up at their practice this fall.
At 6 a.m., right?
At 6 a.m., it was fog covered, it was cold, you know.
It was September, right?
It was September, but it felt more like December there, but interesting thing Coach Murphy kept saying to these guys, play within yourselves, know your range. He really, really preaches these guys to know their range when they're shooting. And he said, if you don't know your range, you go to Coach Abbott, and he's going to tell you your range. He doesn't want guys shooting 15-yard shots for guys that can only shoot 12-yard shots. And the players listen, they know their range, and that's why they're, you know, one of the best shooting teams in the country. And, you know, I believe they're number, like, two or three in extra man offense mm-hmm. last year. So, you know, expect that to continue for Colgate.
And Murphy the head coach, Mike Murphy, is a genius on goalies. So they're all, you know, like we talk about Loyola, Charlie Toomey, Loyola's pretty usually going to have a pretty good goalie, and I think Colgate is sort of in that group as well. They're almost always going to have a good goalie, just like Army did when Murphy was an assistant at Army.
Yeah, I was going to mention Brandon Burke. It might be one of the key attributes to developing shooters is making sure that they're shooting on a high-quality goalie in practice. You know, I think that for Loyola, the thing that concerns me the most is, you know, in welcoming back David Manning, I think that they have the guy who is the quarterback of the defense. But in Manning losing
quarterback, I get it.
There you go. Nice. In losing Pat Frazier, I think that they lost their disruptor. The guy who was able to play out on the edge was the most physically imposing. And as a result, curious to see how that kind of, you know, advances itself, particularly from a personnel perspective. They've got a lot of big guys. I know, you know, Jason Crane is somebody who can play up top or down low and, you know, could potentially be a solution there, in terms of having that range. But I'm not sure whether or not he has the mindset that Frazier put forward last year. You know, I think that they figured out their spine a little bit in terms of, you know, it sounds like they've settled on, it's sophomore Grant Lamone, right?
I think so.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously, after having a tremendous freshman season, 2 years ago, I think, at the Faceoff X, they have, an answer that they can be comfortable with, going forward. The question that I have a little bit is, you know, at the offensive end, at the quarterback spot, you know, when it was Justin Ward for 3 years and then you felt like there was a baton being passed to Nico Pontrello, they just didn't have the playmaking mechanisms that they had the previous couple of seasons. You know, Patrick Spencer, an Under Armour All-American who comes in my opinion, has the ability to play up top or behind, you know, is a pretty natural feeder scorer, a guy that can do both. You know, is he going to immediately take the reins, or is there, you know, Zach Sirico is a little bit more of a traditional feed first type player. You know, is he going to emerge as the quarterback? And then they have a lot of utility, a lot of versatility in their midfield, you know, with Sherlock and Albrecht, guys that can play defense as well. I think that so much of their offensive potency comes down to if Romar Dennis hits the cage 23, 24, 28% of the time, then you got to slide to him. You got to slide early to him, and that opens up so many other opportunities. You know, if he's between 15 and 18%, then you're willing to let him shoot six times and get a goal, maybe a goal and a half per game.
I think their season comes down to, I think Fournier, the long stick midi that we were talking about, Neufeld at Maryland, who's out for the year, but Fournier to me is similar. Mm-hmm. You know, very good defense to offense, very good on, very disruptive, I think, on face-offs as a face-off wing. I love Sherlock. I think he does everything for them. He's almost like what you're describing Frazier was, Terry. You know, I think he does that almost across the whole team, not just for the defense. He's tough. He's physical. He's a good leader, great dodger, good defender, good offensive player. Jeff Chase is a name I'm very curious to see how he does. I think they really missed him last year. He's a very, very savvy offensive player. Missed last year with an ankle injury and has had sort of several, I think, injury, shoulder, ankle in his career. But if he can be healthy, he's a very good offensive player and something they missed because their second midfield just didn't give them a whole lot last year, part of it because they were freshmen and part of it because they loaded up on that first midfield anyway. But Chase is a guy who could float between the first and the second. And if Chase is healthy and playing well, which he would play well, Sherlock can do different things. You know, it just gives them a lot more versatility. I felt like last year they had no versatility. When Manning got hurt, I felt like everyone on defense bumped up. Like Frazier was a great two, then had to be the one. Crane was a great three, then had to be the two. You know, they needed Huggins and some of these freshmen to kind of fill in. And I think they struggled. They lost a lot of one-goal games. I don't think they missed by much, but they missed.
What do you think of Army without John Glessner?
I think they'll be all right. I think I'm very excited to see Shea Mullins, a freshman from Long Island. Very big press clippings from Long Island on him. Went to the prep school last year. I know the Army prep beat Navy prep the first time pretty handily, and the second time Navy prep beat him, I think, by a goal. But there's also a long stick midi who's there now, a freshman from DeMatha, Jimmy Sertic, who was very good at the prep school. And, of course, their attack, Cole Johnson, Connor Cook are back. And it was interesting talking to opposing coaches about Joe Alberici at Army, and they said he literally is an offensive genius. And we've said Mike Murphy's the goalie genius, but Alberici is the offensive genius. And the reason people went zone against Army last year was because they did so many things. He has so many players, and he can invert, he can go mumbos, he can do, you know, 3-3, he can do the Villanova sweep offense, just whatever. He'll watch games with a notebook on TV, and he'll jot down notes on what he wants. You know, he'll steal ideas from other guys, and you have to go to zone because you can't stop all those things. So my thing is, can Army figure out the zone? Because I think you're going to see a lot of it this year.
The interesting thing is, you know, you mentioned that about Alberici and his offense. You know, for the past few years, they've had that alpha male guy on their offense. They've had Glessner. You know, they had Garrett Thole before Boltis. That. They had Jeremy Boltis before that. This is going to be the first year in a while where they really are, you know, when they're playing offense, it's six equals pretty much. You know, it's not the one guy that teams have to focus on. Is that really a strength in Alberici's hands now, kind of having this sleight of hand a little bit where you don't know where the pressure's going to come from? But I do agree with you on Cole Johnson, Connor Cook. you know, they have some of the guys. It's going to be, does someone kind of take that leadership role on the team and carry them a little bit? And, you know, they're always going to be good at short stick defensive mid, even though they graduate a lot there, because, you know, Coach Alberici always has them prepared. They have Tim Stackpole, who's going to be a good guy for transition. And they have the number one incoming recruit, number one incoming goalie in the country, AJ Barreto, who is a small guy, but, you know, kind of in the fall, he looked the part. I'm not sure if he's going to win the starting nod, but, you know, replacing Sam Somers is going to be a tough task. And, you know, he seems to kind of be the guy who, if it's not his year this year, it's definitely going to be in the coming years for that.
I like Glancy, the middie from Philadelphia. I know he can play attack, too. He's a lefty. He's very quick. And I think that he can do a lot of different things. You know, he can do the mumbos. He can do the invert. He can do the Villanova sweep, which Glessner did last year. So I think that he's sort of a guy to keep an eye on as well. Mullins, I'm very excited to see. And not Ted, to put too much pressure on him. But
Ted Glessner is wearing his brother's number now. And he looks just like him. He has that same kind of awkward stride that Glessner had. But so again, there's plenty of guys there. It's just a matter of, you know, it's a lot of smaller pieces to the puzzle as opposed to, you know, one bigger piece that you're voting around.
I've got a prediction to make. I need to figure out how bold I want to be. I definitely think BU finishes in the top six and qualifies for the Patriot League tournament. I'm trying to decide whether or not I think that they win their quarterfinal game and advance to the semifinals. BU was 6-2 at one point last year, rose in the media poll, and then lost their last six games to finish 6-8. They lost to Harvard by two. They lost to Harvard by one, Loyola by two, and Holy Cross by two. And I think, to me, that's a team that ran out of gas because they were playing so many freshmen and sophomores, particularly offensively, that they weren't able to close down the stretch. And I think that they have a ton of talent. It's interesting because just knowing who they have coming back, I like them. That doesn't even account for who they have arriving that I don't even know about, which when you look at what they had offensively last year, in 2014, and how many guys, you know, they had two freshmen that put up 40 points last year. I mean, they, you know, Ryan Pulley has a good thing going. I think that and then on the other end, you know, it's not just about scoring goals. They've got a goalie in Christian Carson Bannister who, you know, is among the elite in college lacrosse. I think that BU is going to be disruptive in the Patriot League tournament in a way that looked like Holy Cross was going to shape up to do last year.
Well, they're certainly good in faceoffs, and they're certainly good in goal. You mentioned Carson Bannister, and Talco, I think, is the faceoff guy. I saw them last year against Navy, and they did sort of look like they hit the wall a little bit, but that game was on TV. You know, it was a kind of a big deal for BU and their program, and I was very impressed. I came away very impressed, but especially in goal and on faceoffs, which is not a bad place to be good at.
The question to me then is, you know, Terry, you just made the somewhat bold prediction that BU is going to crash the Patriot League tournament. Who do they knock out is the question. Presumably, the teams we haven't talked to right now, Bucknell and Lehigh.
Yep.
You know, it's tough to say that BU, you know, this is not a slight against BU, but it's tough to say that these teams that are, you know, good year in, year out, obviously Lehigh had a down year last year. It's tough to say that either of them is going to have a down year this year, another down year.
Well, but BU lost to Lehigh by one in a snow-covered game and then beat Bucknell by two. So, I mean, you know, I think ultimately what it's looking to shape up as is that, you know, they're not far behind. So whether or not they, you know, finish in the top six and advance beyond that, I'm predicting. But at the same time, I'm not saying definitively that it'll happen. I think it's clear, though, that they are not far behind as a program, and I think that, you know, it's impressive when you consider how high the floor is in the Patriot League and how quickly they've gotten beyond the floor.
No question.
It's definitely an impressive, you know, early run to the start of their program that they've had. And just kind of speaking about the other teams right now, you have to remember Bucknell, a team that just seemingly always flies under the radar but then surprises you somewhere along in the season. You know, Will Sands was a freshman last year. They returned Sean Doyle, Thomas Flibbett. They'll be a good team. Their defense is always very, very, very schematically sound and very good. Lehigh, obviously last year was kind of an aberration for them in terms of their recent history. Attackman Tristan Ray is a guy you hear a lot about, a Canadian. Had a very, very good fall game against Villanova that was very, very impressive. And he's expected to do a lot of good things this year.
Yeah, I mean, Lehigh without Dan Taylor is a little bit different. And as a result, I'm going to, you know, take a little bit of a wait and see approach with them.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
The kind of moving on, because I think that there's a correlation to be made between the step forward that BU took and the step forward, you know, moving on to the MAC. I mean, how about what Monmouth did from to go from 0-13 in 2014 to what did they finish last year? 6-8. You know, they have in Garrett Conaway, they had the only goalie in Division I lacrosse that finished above 60%. But they, you know, managed to create some offensive personnel that, you know, stole some games and I think, you know, put them in a position where the Hawks are a serious contender in the MAC. But, you know, when you look at what Marist was able to do in the first play-in game against Bryant last season, and this is Matt after a very dramatic MAC championship, MAC tournament win, and then, you know, to go to Syracuse and comport themselves pretty well a little early. It wasn't as if, you know, it wasn't a repeat of Bryant's two games in the Dome, but still, you know, didn't back down. They graduated a ton of talent. There's no question about it. They lost a couple other guys, you know, particularly at the defensive end. But at the same time, it's a program you're familiar with in J.D. Raycar and Joseph Radin. They've got a 1-2 punch in terms of, you know, they've got the assist guy and the goal scorer. What are your expectations for Marist heading into the season? Do you think that they are the team to beat in the way that they looked like at the end of last year?
I think they're definitely the team to beat in the MAC. I think there's no question about that. Obviously, you know, Monmouth, Quinnipiac, Detroit can give them a run, but I think it's definitely Marist to lose. And they're going to have to learn how to play as a favorite. You know, they're... It's a very blue-collar team. You know, they pride themselves on a lot of hard work. And now, you know, they're dealing with something different. They went to the NCAA tournament. You know, part of me thinks this is the perfect mix for them, where they've tasted some success and they want some more of it. You know, they can kind of come out with this, we know we're good, but we know we still have work to do, and that's a good spot to be in. But as you said, with kind of the 1-2 duo they have, it's the best duo in the MAC right now with Raycor and Joe Radin. You know, the thing about J.D. Raycor, Coach Wilkinson, you know, mentioned to me, you know, doing the Face-Off Yearbook interviews that, you know, Coach Wilkinson was kind of the same position as him when he played at St. Joe's in college. And he's continually amazed watching him make some of the passes that he makes. He's one of those guys who has eyes in the back of his head. He always makes the great first pass, even though it looks like he might be passing into trouble or doing something he shouldn't. He makes a lot of passes that, you know, a lot of guys are not going to make. And he has a guy with Joe Radin, you know, who can put the ball in the net paired with him. So it's going to be a really good offense. You know, they have a lot of losses, especially at the midfield. I really liked Mike Bagley last year. I thought he was one of the best do-it-all guys. But, you know, they're building a culture there. And you know, you're going to see if that culture that they've built is built for long-term success with guys graduating.
I think that the other team to keep an eye on is Detroit.
Yep.
In Jason Weber, you have a goalie who is, you know, if not a first-team All-American level player, a guy who is over 60% for his career. You know, they play at, I don't know that it's fair to you know, watch what they did in their NCAA tournament season and kind of just put that blueprint over Detroit and say this is who they always are. You know, but in that year they were high pressure, a lot of cause turnovers type defense. You know, looking back on it, their win over Ohio State in 2015 might be the biggest surprise or biggest upset in retrospect. You know, it's a club that when you have a goalie that's that good, when you have, you know, some offensive talent that is really able to score goals in bunches, you're constantly going to be a threat. And I'll be curious to see how that continues to develop over the course of this MAC campaign, particularly when you're dealing with a relatively uncommon phenomenon, that being Siena not being the team that comes into 2016 with all the expectations.
Yeah, and great, as you guys have said, it's a great conference for goalies.
Moving on, the NEC, we mentioned obviously that Bryant continued their reign in that league, lost to Marist in the play-in game last season, graduated one of the top face-off specialists in the country in Kevin Massa, but returned Gunnar Walt, a goalie who was a multi-time All-American. Probably the favorite, but at the same time, you look for Mike Pressler's disciple, Taylor Ray, at St. Joe's and say, this is a program that has really started to flourish and probably the team that has, at least from my perspective, in all of college lacrosse, made the farthest strides and not gotten to the NCAA tournament yet. So you wonder if this is the year. Guys, got any thoughts on whether or not St. Joe's has enough to go over the top this season?
I know that they looked very good against Villanova in the fall in the scrimmages. I think Lehigh was the third team up there in those scrimmages. And Matt, you've seen them in person a bunch at practices and games, and you've been always impressed by them, St. Joe's.
Yeah, they're definitely another team. You know, kind of I put them in a similar vein as Marist in terms of, you know, the coaching staff there has built a culture that you're seeing kind of some of the dividends pay off there. And, you know, for them, it's just that one more step that they need to take, which is the NCAA tournament. Are they good enough to do it? Absolutely. I think it's them and Bryant. It's just a matter of who wins that game, you know, when it matters in the NEC tournament. Mike Restivo is probably, I would say, the best attackman in the league. Him and, you know, Tucker James at Bryant. But, you know, they're a team that they kind of hung right with Virginia last year. You know, they had a really big lead against Penn last year that they ended up just blowing late. In a really, really cold weeknight game up in Philadelphia.
You were there.
And I was there at that one. You know, so they have some cleaning up to do. They need to clean up on defense. They need to kind of not shoot themselves in the foot sometimes. But they're a team that has the horses there to make, you know, a push to the NCAA tournament, that's for sure.
Be remiss to talk about the NEC without talking about the strides that Wagner made last year. You know, it's a team that wasn't very familiar with winning, I believe, 3 years in a row. Went winless in the mid-2000s. You know, and the job that Will Manny has done an assistant supporting role to Matt Poske is really impressive, and I think that you know, the Seahawks have some good young offensive talent that they can rely on, and it'll be you know, fascinating to see exactly how far they can make strides this season. Let's go ahead and bring part three in for a landing. We're going to talk about the Southern Conference, the newest league on the NCAA lacrosse landscape. Undergoes a little bit of a transition this year as they welcome Air Force in as an affiliate. High Point was the Southern Conference champion in 2015 after Richmond won the league as a debutante in 2014. Both teams have faced each other in the SoCon championship game each of the last 2 years, and probably head into this season with the highest level of expectations between them as well. You know, High Point is a team that in Matt Thistle and Dan Lomas have one of those 1-2 punch combinations that is similar to you know, what we were talking about with Marist. An assist guy, a playmaker in Thistle, a goal scorer in Lomas. At the same time, they've got what appears like it'll be an interesting face-off monster, both in Jamie Peluso, who returns, you know, as one of the top 10 draw takers in the country, and then welcoming in Alex Woodall, who I think you can make an argument is one of the most intriguing freshmen out of St.
No
Mary's
question.
Annapolis.
No question. I think he's one of the most intriguing in years. He was recruited by everybody. I mean, I'm very excited to see how he does at the college level.
And they have a huge, relatively big question mark in Austin Geisler, who graduated after being, you know, basically the goalie that played all throughout his 3 seasons at High Point, a Virginia transfer. So, you know, a new starter in goal will be an interesting challenge for High Point as well. You know, the Panthers are good. There's no question about it. I think the question becomes, you know, what is Air Force add to the equation at the top of the league, and you know, does Richmond manage to figure out a way to swing the pendulum back towards themselves this year?
I was impressed talking to John Torpy, the High Point coach. You know, he is another one of the coaches who doesn't do anything in the fall. He keeps it all in-house. They don't go out to outside events. When I asked him why, he said part of the reason is just logistics. You know, they don't want to burn their budget on a fall, traveling to a fall event. They're down in North Carolina. But part of it, he said, he's like, look, we're installing our offense and our defense, and we want to do it at our pace. We don't want to say, oh, we have to get this installed by October X. You know, if it takes more time, they want to have that time. And so I'm very impressed with sort of how he's developing that program, and they said they have plenty of talent. I think they have a freshman goalie, Timmy, he's from St. Mary's Annapolis as
yep.
well, who I think might be in the mix. That's it, who might be in the mix to start. Certainly, I think they have a top 10 recruiting class,
yep.
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they're right there on the border. Obviously, Woodall and Troutner were, you know, really considerable players coming in. You know, they also have Quinn Eisler, whose older brother Kieran Eisler is a contributor at Johns Hopkins.
And there's a defenseman that you wrote about whom they really like.
Yeah, kid from Portland. No, and I think that, you know, I was fortunate to check out High Point's practice. you know, this off season, or excuse me, this fall. And you know, just kind of to start, there are two guys that immediately jump off the page, and you know, Benny Pugh, their goalie, is you know, key, integral to integral to what Richmond does. It's kind of hard in those types of settings, in my opinion, to really get a good sense of whether it's separation between goalies, because I thought, you know, the backup came in and played pretty well as well, or really just, you know, how do you stack up? Practice shots are so different from game shots. Guys who are familiar with your tendencies are so different from opponents. Two guys that athletically immediately jumped off the page, and there were a lot of guys missing at the practice I attended, were Mitty Alex Hayden and defenseman
Brendan Hines.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just starting with Hines, he, you know, and I know that this is really high praise, and there are a lot of things that go into the comparison that don't have anything to do with on-field play, but, you know, he's tall, he's got a pretty good hunch, and he's redheaded. So he kind of reminds you of Brody Merrill. He can play up top and he can play down low. He's got a lot of range. He plays a little bit of an edge. So, you know, he's not the only mainstay on that Richmond defense that's returning, but definitely a guy that immediately jumps off the page. And then Hayden, you know, he's a little bit short, but he's really good in both getting, I'm trying to think about the right way to say this. He can get to the shooting spot, but he also, through, you know, quickness and explosiveness in his dodging, but he also is really good at figuring out how to make the right decision and move the ball to the right spot. You know, seems like the senior leader on that group, although, like I said, you know, one of the caveats being there were a lot of guys missing from practice. And then one guy I want to mention is Adrian Nash, a freshman out of Central New York, who, you know, at one point was on Loyola's radar, I think was on Syracuse's radar for a period of time. You know, he's a good player. He's a really good player. He's explosive, can go end to end. He's athletic. I think Richmond's going to be right where they have been the previous 2 years, if not a step ahead.
And it's funny, you know, we're talking about new programs here, and look how far we're going down the depth chart of players who are really good. We didn't even mention Mitch Goldberg for Richmond. And he's a player 2 years ago who really stormed onto the scene and got a lot of attention. You know, he can play both attack and midfield. I know he's played both there for him. So it just shows where these new programs are coming from and how much talent's out there that, you know, it's only a few years removed from the start of the program. And, you know, we're already talking about guys who, you know, aren't necessarily just their star players who are making an impact. It's guys further down, you know, in the second line midfield and the depth players.
I love that we've gone through this whole podcast, all three parts, and have not talked about who might be the best attackman in the country. Brody Eastwood at Stony Brook, who I think might wind up scoring 60 goals this year. He was well over 50 last year. An amazing finisher. I think it just shows the great depth that there is in lacrosse. And partly that I should have remembered to mention Brody Eastwood when we talked about Stony Brook, to be fair. But I think it's just another thing to be really excited about the season for, because almost every team has either some scheme or players that are really deserving to watch.
Well, it's a good transition, though, because as we bring this thing in for landing, is there anything that we haven't discussed, you know, whether it be from, you know, number one Notre Dame into debutante Hampton that deserves attention heading into the spring?
I'm curious, and I think this is for a different podcast. I do think we need to address, I'm going to bring up the two words we're not supposed to, but the Final Four. I think we need to bring up the Final Four, and again, not today, but at some point, I'd like to sort of, I think it deserves a deep dive, kind of what the future is and what sort of ideas are out there, if it does indeed need to change.
Do you have a strong opinion?
Not necessarily, no, okay. But I do think that we need to look at other options. And I'm not saying we need to use any one of them, but I do think it would be helpful to look at them. And I should say it's actually Kevin Warren's idea at Georgetown. His idea is just to move have the semifinals on that Saturday, you know, Memorial Day weekend, D1 semifinals, D2 semifinals, D3 semifinals, and then the following weekend, that first weekend in June, you have all three title games and all, you know, probably at different places. I think his idea is to have the title games be at the same place every year. Annapolis, I think, was his idea. And Annapolis is a non-starter for the semifinals because it's Naval Academy's graduation and the place is booked. So, but I thought that was pretty interesting. You're only adding 1 week to the calendar that these teams have to stay on campus. You're going to get a much better title game, and you're going to give the D2 and D3 games the love they deserve. You know, I cannot tell you how many times I've walked out of the Final Four, sorry, weekend, and said that D3 game was the best game I saw, or Tufts was the best team I saw, or wasn't it great all those Lynchburg fans showed up in all the red last year for their team's first appearance in that title game. I mean, last year, Tufts, I think, had 50-something shots on goal and only 10 turnovers. Like, that's how you play up-tempo lacrosse.
What do you think about the idea of having either the quarterfinals and the semifinals on the same weekend, you know, Memorial Day weekend, utilize the extra day, you know, play Friday, Sunday, one set, and then play the other set Saturday, Monday, or theoretically having the first round of the quarterfinals on the same weekend. Is there anything in there that you think is appealing?
I wouldn't say no. I think there's some merit to that, but I haven't really thought about it.
To me, the thing that should be a goal is moving Selection Sunday back, because what that does is it opens up more opportunity for high-profile marquee games when the weather is nice all throughout the country in late April and early May.
Not to always quote Georgetown coaches, but Dave Yurek always said, it's too bad we finally have good weather in late April, early May, and some of the teams are gone.
Yeah.
That brings me to my next point. When you talk about any other storylines kind of heading into this season, the cold weather games, you know, I'm wondering if the pendulum is starting to swing the other way now with team scheduling games. Still in February, but maybe 2 weeks later. You know, in this segment of the podcast, we talked about St. Joe's. He mentions in their press release about the schedule how they made, you know, purposeful steps to add a scrimmage early in the spring and move back their season so they're not playing so many February games. They will have played, in last year, they would have been on game three by the time that they're playing game one this year. That game against Penn that I referenced earlier, it's one of the coldest games I've ever been to. You know, they're a team that's in Philadelphia. There's presumably going to be snow in February. You know, maybe we're starting to see the pendulum swing ever so slightly that way, and maybe that's going to result in, you know, rethinking of Memorial Day and pushing the season into the summer a little bit more.
Well, it's always sunny in Philadelphia. Oh, no, wait, that's the TV show. I'm curious, you know, people following the Duke model in terms of what they do in the fall, which is to say not to do an outside event in the fall. But Duke's model, part of the reason they do that is because they want to save all 17 of their NCAA competition dates for the spring, and they play a lot of midweek games. Now, I appreciate that their climate is a little bit different from, as you say, a team in Philadelphia. But I'm curious if that might become a little bit of a model, too, whereas you can fudge the start of the schedule a little bit because you're going to play more Wednesday, Saturday as the season goes on.
My thing about that is I think that the NCAA should narrow the potential number of dates. So right now you have to play 12 games, and you can play as many as 17 before getting to non-scheduled games, which essentially means conference tournament games. I think that gap is too wide, and I think that the reason it's too wide is because it means that there's a lot of flexibility in the way that you build your schedule as to whether or not you include midweek games. I don't think coaches are necessarily opposed to midweek games. I think they're opposed to, we are playing a midweek game, right, and our Saturday opponent is not. So we only have 2 days to prepare, both from a tactical and from a preparation, body preparation standpoint, whereas our opponent has six. And that inequity is a really key determining factor in whether or not you are likely to win your Saturday game. And if your Saturday game is a league game, and your league game determines when you get it, whether you get into your conference tournament, and your conference tournament whether determines whether you get your AQ, and whether or not you get into the NCAA tournament determines what your year-end review is with your athletic director and boss, that is a cascading effect that I can understand. And I think that the NCAA restricting that number, making it you have to play 14, you can only play 16, or something like that, would yield a positive gain in the rise of midweek games, which would be part and parcel to pushing the season a little bit back so it doesn't start as early in February.
Yeah, right. Sounds good to me. The only other thing I would say, Jerry Price says that Sam Gravett, one of their starting defensemen, is an amazing singer. I guess his mother was a Broadway singer.
Yeah.
And there's video on the Princeton website of him singing. So I've just embarrassed, if he's listening, I've just embarrassed him, I think. But it is quite impressive.
Well, then you've just given everybody an opportunity or a thought for what to do next as this podcast winds down. Find that online. And we appreciate the listenership. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you found it informative. And we'll be back in the spring, but we'll also be back in the fall of 2016 to do this all again. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.